Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Bill Butts, and he'll be answering your most important questions on freshwater stripers on the fly. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Bill a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted in the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Bill Butts about freshwater stripers on the fly. Our approach is simple, education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like short line nymphing, tactics for tough days, still water fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's www.flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. Before we introduce Bill, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for the link under Bill's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form. We'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a $20 gift certificate courtesy of Front Range Anglers in Boulder, Colorado. And they're at www.frontrangeanglers.com. Now, to win that gift certificate, which you can redeem either in person at their shop or online in their store, to win that, you have to be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question is going to be something Bill and I have talked about during the show, and you'll have to submit your answer along with your name and location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills at the end of the show, and maybe you'll win that $20 gift certificate. Bill Butts began his 40-year journey in the sport and arts of fly fishing on small lakes and trout streams in Missouri and the Arkansas Ozarks. He has fly fished across the U.S. and Canada for many species, including trout, largemouth bass, smallmouth bass, crappie, and perch species, salmon and steelhead, muskies, northern pike, and walleye, blue sharks, and his favorites, the temperate basses, striped, hybrid striped, and white bass. Many years ago, he was fortunate to have become friends with many of the fly fishing industry leaders that willingly mentored him in the skills of fly casting, fly tying, and photography. Dave Whitlock and Lefty Cray are credited with being the most influential. Bill strives to share his passion and enthusiasm for fly fishing with newcomers to the sport and anyone who requests his help. He firmly believes the sharing attitude that permeates a great sport is the very foundation of what makes it so great. Bill has contributed several web articles on fly fishing for temperate basses on fly shop websites, including Fly Masters of Indianapolis and the Mountain River Fly Shop in Arkansas. A selection of PowerPoint-based programs on the popular temperate basses, from a simple springtime fly fishing for white bass program to a comprehensive program covering 3 of the primary temperate bass species, has been developed, which he presents to interested fly shops, fly fishing clubs, and at fly fishing events. He was featured in an Itinerant Angler podcast entitled White Bass and Striper Masterclass, which was subsequently featured on midcurrent.com. A book and instructional DVD on the subject of fly fishing for temperate bass are in their infancy stages. Well, Bill, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thank you, Roger. It's a pleasure to join you this evening.
Well, good. We've got lots to talk about, and we're covering freshwater stripers in this show. I know we did get one question that I think was on salt, so just so that nobody gets confused during the show, All we're talking about is freshwater stripers tonight. So, well, let's dig right in here. You've had a lot of experience with freshwater stripers and fly fishing for them specifically. But let's kind of sort out, what is a freshwater striper?
Well, that's a really good question, Roger, and one that I guess I don't think about much. But technically, a freshwater striper is a striper that has no access to salt water. And you have to understand a little bit about saltwater stripers, and that's where our freshwater stripers originated. They are truly a marine fish in origin, but saltwater stripers spawn in freshwater rivers, so they are anadromous, like salmon. And so we don't count those as freshwater stripers. What we're talking about are stripass, which are landlocked, no access to the ocean, whether they're in rivers, lakes, or both. They're landlocked and what some people call inland stripers.
How did the striper, it's not native to these freshwater lakes and rivers, is it? I mean, was it brought in as a stocked fish at some point?
Actually, the first record, I guess you would say, in the history of freshwater striped bass goes back into the state of South Carolina. I believe it was in the 1940s when they were working on the Santee Cooper River system. There were two dams that were built damming up some rivers, and they knew that the stripers, at the time that they were going to close those dams, that the stripers were in the rivers from the ocean. And I guess at that time, from what I've read, again, they just assumed those fish would not survive. Well, they found that they not only survived, but they thrived and continued in that particular fishery to reproduce in the rivers. And just in recent years, it's my understanding that they actually had done some studies, and I guess these were genetic studies or something, that determined that as far back as that time, that some of those fish were, they verified that they were actually river residents. They were not fish that left the river, went to the ocean, and came back. But I would venture to guess that there were some of both, some that did go out and come back. So that was where it all started in terms of fisheries people understanding that stripers, saltwater stripers, could in fact not only spawn in freshwater but live in freshwater year-round and grow very, very well.
So nowadays the fish that are in freshwater and landlocked are spawning and procreating. They're not stocked every year like some of the hybrids and so forth.
Well, that's actually another topic, and the answer to that is that there are actually very few fisheries across the country that are pure freshwater fisheries for stripers that are able to have self-sustaining, or what I call wild striper fisheries in the country. And the reason is the way that they spawn when they drop their eggs in moving water, whether it's occasionally in windswept, very windy lakes, but more often than not in rivers, those eggs have to be able to drift for up to 3 days, 48 to 72 hours, before they hatch. And if they don't have that kind of length of river in oxygenated water, they can't survive. They just sink to the bottom and they die. So as a result, across the country, a lot of them that go through the motions of spawning don't successfully spawn. So in most cases, in most fisheries across the country, stripers are spawned in hatchery settings and stocked into the specific lake and fisheries across the country.
What kind of lifespan do they have, then, as a stocked fish like?
Well, in terms of lifespan and size, I'm seeing that some of the largest freshwater stripers, and by the way, stripers in freshwater actually grow faster than they do in the ocean or marine environment because they are in smaller waters. They may be in a 20 or 50,000 acre lake, but that's a lot different than covering perhaps hundreds of miles of ocean. So they're kind of the top of the food chain. They don't have to expend quite as much energy. They really put on the weight a lot quicker than their marine family, their cousins in the marine. But they will get up into the 60-pound range. I believe the freshwater record is in the 70-something pound range. There are fish caught every year, not very many, that will exceed 60 pounds. And those fish will be somewhere in the 12 to 15-year-old age category, best I can tell.
Okay. So those equal in size, basically, to saltwater.
They do. They do. And I couldn't tell you in terms of, you know, number of anglers, how many are caught that are, say, 20 to 40 pounds, which are certainly trophy stripers in any fishery, saltwater versus freshwater, but I just don't have any information on that. But they definitely grow quicker in freshwater because of their environment is different. Certainly open water fish, what you call pelagic fish, open water roamers, almost constantly on the roam, but where they have good food base, forage base, they can really put on the weight, you know, pretty rapidly each year.
I know, of course, in the ocean they're seasonal. There are certain runs they have every year and so forth, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. are they seasonal in freshwater?
Well, I guess you have to define what seasonal is. In terms of the ocean fish, they're seasonal from the standpoint that they go up into the rivers to spawn. Well, in freshwater, they're spring spawners also, and that presents a seasonal opportunity, if you will. Below tailwater dams, in certain river systems, you have a what most people just call a spawning season or spawning run that will last a few weeks each spring. And then there's a lead up to that and a post-spawn activity where they feed heavily and that kind of thing. But they are available where there is water that isn't excessively cold, let's say northern Illinois or up in the northern plain states where there are stripers in some fisheries. Those lakes freeze over most winters, so it's kind of hard to fish for them unless it's through the ice. But in our south central U.S. area where I am, and in the south and in the southeast where there are a number of striper fisheries, it really is a 12-month fishery for those fish, but it's seasonal on what their patterns and activities are. You may find them in the rivers in the spring and in cool water rivers in the summer if they're available to them to escape the warm lake water. Other than that, they, in the summer, seek deeper water in the lakes, and they're a little more difficult for fly fishermen to access because they are in 30 to 50 or 60 feet of water, and that makes it pretty tough.
Now, when they are spawning and so forth, or their pseudo-spawn or whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. If they're in a lake, will they then run up any incoming rivers to move into those waters? Or
yes. Yes, they will. I guess the exception is, and this varies with the fishery greatly, but if you have a fishery that doesn't have major flowing tributaries, let's say, for example, one in my area that's probably one of the largest rivers that has them, and these are wild stripers, is the Arkansas River, which flows through several states but traverses the states of Oklahoma and Arkansas. And you have wild, self-sustaining, spawning, successfully reproducing stripers up and down that fishery, and they will go up some distance. Usually they'll stop at a dam, although there's lock and dams where they can kind of get through, and they will actually spawn in those rivers, or they will go up one of the tributaries that leads to perhaps another tailwater dam below a lake, and they will spawn sometimes, or at least try to spawn in those tributaries. But in that particular fishery, the Arkansas River, it is not stocked, has not been for many, many years. They're not native, obviously, but they haven't been stocked for many, many years. And it is a self-sustaining wild fishery.
So does that present better fly fishing opportunities then during that spring spawn, or is that a time you wouldn't target them?
That's probably one of the most popular for not only fly fishermen, but for conventional tackle fishermen too, because they understand that those fish will sometimes congregate, I guess you would say, in some numbers, perhaps below dams, which we have many of in the country and certainly in the middle and south central part of the country. So they are, I guess you would say, more locatable, and even though in some of those fisheries, many of them in fact, they are not successfully spawning, they do go through the motions. And that brings them up rivers, out of lakes, and that can be some pretty exciting fishing. So, yes, that's a particular time when people think of fishing for them. But also, because temperate bass, and particular stripers, they really thrive in water temperatures that are from about 55 to 75 degrees. They also function very, very well in water that's colder than 55. So, for example, in our south central U.S., the Ozark Mountain region where I live, which covers part of three states, Missouri, Arkansas, and Oklahoma, the summer fishing is probably the toughest time because in most fisheries they're very deep and they are stressed sometimes because of low oxygen, and it's not a particularly good time to try to catch a big striper and try to release them, which we do in most cases. but they tolerate the real cool to cold water in the winter, and some of the best fishing at or near the surface of the water, in shallower water, is through the coldest months of the year. So it's a little different than most people think of, say, with typical bass fishing, which is almost all deep in the wintertime in the colder months. But these fish come from a temperate climate, and that's where the name comes from, and they really like water that's just a little bit cooler than our normal native fish.
So I know we've got some questions coming up about different locations for stripers, but from what you're saying, telling me then, it sounds like, depending on where you are in the country, and I understand stripers are in quite a few locations, that if you don't have a winter freeze over, then you might do very well, and the fish might be closer to the surface than during the winter time and more accessible.
Yes. To give you an example of that, Roger, my good friend Dave Whitlock, who has done a lot of striper fishing and lived for a number of years in Arkansas near both Bull Shoals and Norfolk Lakes, when he learned to catch big stripers, and I'm talking 15 to 30-pound plus stripers, on Norfolk Lake, which is one of our Ozarks lakes, most of those were caught in the colder months of the year, and those fish were caught from the surface or right at the surface down just, you know, 2 or 3 feet.
Okay.
And they caught lots and lots of those fish, and it's amazing. It was a phenomenal fishery, but in the summer right now, the water temperature for the surface water temperatures would be in the high 80s to low 90s in that same fishery. And that's not very comfortable for a striped bass.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's we did have a question from Woody in Las Vegas. He wants to know, are there, other than the ones you've talked about already, behavioral differences between saltwater stripers and freshwater stripers?
Behavioral differences, well, there's some similarities. I made a couple notes on that question. Both fish, marine or freshwater, are pelagic, meaning they roam open waters for the most part. And for that reason, they have to locate bait fish, forage, that are likewise, they're open water roamers. And, of course, in freshwater, most of the fisheries in the U.S. have either gizzard shad or threadfin shad or both. And there's some similarities there in that they roam open waters. I don't know if that's a behavioral difference or not. That's really more of a similarity. I mentioned
That kind of clears up. You know, they're probably not under structures and so forth. If you're looking,
right, they're not territorial from the standpoint of taking up residence around a big fallen log, like maybe a big old largemouth bass or something like that.
Right.
I mentioned before the difference, and it's not a behavioral difference, but the difference that freshwater stripers do grow faster, but both marine and freshwater stripers travel and hunt in either schools or packs. And I'll kind of clarify that. A school would be perhaps hundreds of fish, dozens to hundreds, small school, big school, whether it's in saltwater or freshwater. In freshwater, the large schools of stripers you would find would be what we call schoolies. They would be fish that would be yearling fish of 1 to 2 pounds, perhaps a little bit bigger, or maybe in the 4 to 6 pound range. Those are all kind of what we call schoolies, and they will travel in, sometimes in pretty good size schools. But then when I say a pack, as those fish get larger, it's been my experience that they travel in smaller and smaller groups to hunt and feed, and as they get to very large outsized fish, 25 to 40, 50 pounds, sometimes they become almost solitary, very, very small groups of 3 or 4 or 6 fish, and this has not been because I've caught a lot of those fish, but I know some guides who know these fish inside and out, and they're not fly fishing guides, but they're guys who live it and breathe it almost every day of the year, and that's what I've learned from them, that the bigger the fish get, they travel in smaller schools, kind of or packs away from the smaller fish.
I've got some follow-up questions on that, but we do need to take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk with Bill more about freshwater stripers on the fly. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They also provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. located conveniently on US 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Bill Butts about freshwater stripers on the fly. If you'd like to ask Bill a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Bill, I know you're primarily what I would call a gentleman fly fisher in that you don't really participate in the commercial aspects of the sport, but I know you have an interest in producing, you're working on a book and possibly a DVD, and I know you like to stay connected with folks, so can you talk just a bit about, you know, what you're maybe thinking about in your book and how you like to stay connected and maybe how other people can get connected regarding striped bass?
Absolutely, Roger. As I mentioned to you previously, I really feel like that the fly fishermen who really seek striped bass and temperate bass of all types, the white bass, the hybrid stripers, are a pretty small niche of the fly fishing community. I really believe that from the conversations I've had in clubs and shops and at fly fishing events, that there are a lot of guys who would really like to catch these fish and spend more time doing it, but it takes a lot of time to understand, quite a bit of experience, unless you have someone that can take you, a friend maybe that's already done this, or a guide or something like that. But it's really a pretty small niche. And what my passion is to learn as much as I can. And I've been doing this a long time, but I find that I just still have a lot to learn. And I'm always wanting to network with other fishermen, whether they're beginning, intermediate, advanced level. And I talk to a lot of guys who fish conventional tackle and even bait, you know, live bait fishing, to learn from them where and how to find these fish on a particular fishery. And they're all just a little bit different for different reasons. So there's not a lot of hard and fast rules in this particular game. But as I mentioned to you, I would really like to provide my email address so that people in any part of the country that are interested in freshwater striping and trying to learn how to work through the what I call a puzzle of issues to success for this, to catch them with flies, and you know, to be able to communicate with them and maybe be able to coach them a little bit, mentor them a little bit. But I learn in the process too as I try to help people with their particular fishery, and I actually learn more about what I'm doing in the region that I fish, too. So it's a kind of a mutually beneficial thing, and that's kind of where I come from. I enjoy sharing it and getting people turned on to it and trying to feed their interest of learning more about it to be successful and enjoy just an awesome, awesome fish.
You mentioned earlier, too, that you wouldn't mind sharing your email address in case
yes.
people want to have follow-up questions or so
mm-hmm.
forth.
Mm-hmm. You want to do that now?
Sure.
Okay, and I thought you might be able to post it on the website.
I can do that,
put the podcast, but it's fairly simple. It's bill.butts, B-U-T-T-S, at sbcglobal.net. SBC is Sam Bravo Charlie, sbcglobal.net, and that'll get right to me.
And I will post that on the site for folks so that
okay.
if they missed it here, they can pick it up on the...
Great. I'd love to hear from people, whether it's a question about flies or tackle or a particular fishery, and I may not be familiar with it, but I can help them work through the puzzle to try to help them get successful catching those fish.
Great, great. Well, we've got a few questions about location. Well, first of all, you know, stripers can be found throughout the United States, I believe. Are they also found in other countries? Or?
You know, that's something I honestly don't know much about. I know that on the other side of the Atlantic that there is a, I'm trying to think what they call it, a channel bass or white bass or something like that. It's a looks very much like a striper that I have seen, but I don't honestly know whether they're stocking these in freshwater lakes across the globe or not. That's just something I don't know about.
Okay, okay. But they're prevalent in a lot of states in the U.S., correct?
They really are, and I will say that in addition to the stripers, that the hybrid striper has really been stocked and utilized by fisheries folks more widely than even the striped bass. They don't get as large, but there are some reasons why they're very desirable to use and they are actually more popular in terms of the number of fisheries they are in across the country. Having said that, back to the stripers themselves, I think that even though there are freshwater stripers literally from coast to coast, there's one gentleman from Virginia that has a question about a lake there, and got one of the most educated and really technically knowledgeable bunch of freshwater striper fishermen that I know of in this country are on the west coast in the Bay Area, Sacramento area, that fish that Delta and the lower Sacramento and the lower American rivers and that. So it's virtually coast to coast, but I really believe that freshwater stripers in general are probably more common and more concentrated in as far as number of fisheries in states like Oklahoma, Arkansas, Texas, Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, basically your south central and southeast U.S. And there's some tremendous fisheries.
Tom in Roswell, Georgia wanted to know, what's your favorite lake or river for stripers?
What is my favorite lake or river? Well, I don't know if I have a single one. And it's interesting, in our region, as I mentioned, it's the Ozark Mountain region, which encompasses three states. We fish on lakes. We fish on rivers, which probably my favorite. I like flowing water. But we fish a lot in Oklahoma and in Arkansas. I probably don't have a favorite. I really don't. But I think that the one that probably, if there is one that's even close, the Arkansas River in Oklahoma would have to be right at the top. And I think one of the reasons is it's a very mysterious, big, wide prairie river, and the fish in that river are wild. They are reproducing naturally. And from that river, they also go up into other tributaries that we fish. Some are cool water, and they're very good to fish in this hot weather. So I guess the Arkansas River and its tributaries are my favorite, or really close to it.
You mentioned wild. Do you find the wild fish are stronger, fight better, more resilient than the stockers?
I'm not sure I've noticed the difference.
Okay.
Size for size, 6-pound fish to 6-pound fish. I'm not sure that there's all that much difference there. You know, depending on the time of year you catch them, and if they happen to be a little bit stressed from being in too warm a water, that can affect their energy level. Their metabolism gets very, very low. And and so seasonal type things that can affect them in different fisheries, I'm not sure. I have a very good read on that. My initial response to that would be, I think they're pretty close to the same. They're very powerful fish.
Woody in Las Vegas wants to know, have you had any experience on Lake Mead, Lake Powell, or Lake Mojave?
Roger, I've not, and I've heard more and more about that, and it interests me because it's my understanding that there are parts of that river system, which I believe is all the Colorado River system, or at least the Colorado River and maybe one of its tributaries. It's my understanding that there's actually some natural spawn going on, natural reproduction, which is wonderful because that helps sustain that fishery. But from what little I know about Lake Mead, it was first stocked in the late 60s, just for a few years. And then they somehow observed, I guess they were watching, in the early 70s, 73, 74, somewhere in there, they determined that those fish were actually naturally reproducing, so they quit stocking, at least for some period of time. But today, and for a number of years, it's my understanding that that is the dominant game fish of most of those fisheries. I know for sure it is on Lake Mead, and I believe maybe the other two also, but
I know that
I don't know a lot about.
I didn't get to fish for them, but I know they're in Lake Powell.
Mm-hmm.
We're on a houseboat there, and we could actually see some boils or nervous water out there, and unfortunately we didn't have a small boat to go after them. But, and a houseboat doesn't give very good chase. So,
yeah, that might give you away as to human being heading for them.
yeah, but I know they're in there too. Let's talk a little bit about flies, and, you know, first of all, you'd mentioned before that stripers feed on shad, primarily bait fish. Are there other bait fish they go after other than shad?
There are. I think the prevalence or the availability of both the threadfin shad and gizzard shad, and I'll tell you a little bit about the difference in those two, are so widespread that that's always the first one that people think of. And stripers are opportunistic feeders, but they don't isolate themselves just to the pelagic bait fish like shad. A threadfin shad, which is more of a southern and smaller bait fish, and a shad is a member of the herring family, so they look like little tiny tarpon, I guess you'd say. they will only get up to about 3 to 3.5 inches at full size. And from a latitude standpoint, about the state line of Missouri and Arkansas, if you extend that across the U.S., and that's a very rough estimate, that's about the northern boundary for threadfin shad. So you have lots of them in the southeast and southern Texas, Alabama, all that. They're very common. But in many fisheries, and we have it in our Ozark region, you have gizzard shad, which can get up in the 14 and maybe even 15-inch range, very large, but still look basically the same. Same profile, very much similar looking, but just much larger in their adult age. Those are the primary bait fish. And interestingly, stripers in some fisheries were not really stocked in order to establish a trophy game fish type situation. They were really put in to try to control the gizzard shad populations, which are the larger of the two shad, in order to keep them from just overtaking these lakes.
Okay.
But they found that the stripers fed on them so effectively and efficiently that it created a trophy fishery in the process. Now, that's kind of the shad. There's also, mostly in the south and southeast, there's another member of the herring family called a skipjack herring. And it really looks like a little baby tarpon, and that is one of the favorite foods of trophy size stripers. I'm talking 25 or 30 pounds and larger, especially you get down in that Cumberland River system, which is probably the number one trophy striper fishery in freshwater in this country. And they will use up to, get this, up to 24-inch skipjack herring as bait.
Wow.
It takes a big fish to swallow one of those. But they commonly use them 16 to 24 inches to catch stripers that are 40 to 60 pounds. And that's a chunk. But I don't have any flies that are quite that big.
Okay.
And also in the tributaries that stripers are able to get up into that are cool or cold water tributaries that support trout, perhaps even a put-and-take trout fishery, and there are many of them like that. Some in Oklahoma, Arkansas, Tennessee has a number of them. Rainbow trout is also a favorite forage. In most of those fisheries, those trout are stocked, so unfortunately that kind of eats in on some of their stocked rainbow trout or brown trout, but they love those trout in that cold water, but they're really in the cold water to get out of the hot water of the lake, so they've got plenty to eat in the lakes.
So primarily they're after bait fish, shad or herring.
Yes.
Sometimes trout. So I assume that's what we're trying to simulate as far as the flies go.
I think that when you're focusing on fly patterns, that's the majority of what you're going to be looking at.
Roger in Cheyenne, Wyoming wanted to know, what are your three go-to flies for subsurface fishing stripers and in what colors?
Good question. I would say that generally everybody knows what a Clouser minnow is, Clouser deep minnow with the lead eyes that rides hook up. I think with all the different variations of that fly, including kind of the original simplified version that Bob Clouser originally tied, and all its variations, the half and half that he and Lefty have kind of popularized, even a fly, and I'm not sure whether the Clouser minnow or Dan Blanton's name just left me, I'll think of it in a minute, not the Sarmel Mac, just left me. But anyway, he has a lead-eyed fly that's tied on a jig hook now that's sort of a similar concept. Those type flies are probably the most popular and what, over the last 10 years, I have used the most. In addition to that, I really like the Cowan's baitfish, Henry Cowan's in Georgia. He has a baitfish pattern that does not have lead eyes, that has a real nice tall profile the way it's tied, so you get a really good profile of a shad or a trout or whatever you're trying to imitate, but particularly the shad, which are sort of a deep-bodied bait fish. That's an excellent pattern. And then I really like the Whitlock sheep shad series, which one has lead eyes and the other one is not weighted and both of them ride hookup. Those are probably the three that I really like and recommend the most. Colors, and that's kind of a whole chapter in itself, but I think most people that fish for temperate bass, certainly stripers too, will fish the common, most popular colors, and they still are good. Chartreuse and white is excellent. Gray and white is excellent. I use a lot of variations of light and bright colors. Those are really good. One is a neutral color, more of a shad imitation type color, kind of a dark gray and white. And the chartreuse is really good in low light conditions or in stained water, murky to muddy water. Those are the two go-to colors. There are a lot of different variations of colors that I use.
Well, I wonder how many fish, and I don't just mean striped bass, I wonder how many fish have been caught on that chartreuse and white clouser minnow. I mean, there's got to be hundreds of thousands of fish. That works so good for so many fish.
Well, 10 or 15 years ago, I remember Lefty writing something that said he was trying to track how many different species they'd caught around the globe, you know, freshwater.
Right.
And he was actually counting his, and then he thought he maybe knew. But, you know, it's probably in the hundreds of species, both fresh and salt water.
Yeah,
just a good fly pattern.
Yeah, good all-around minnow fly pattern. Question did come in on the Internet, Ted Murphy in Nixa, Missouri. He said, what fly pattern would you consider your best producer and has accounted for your largest on average fish, both subsurface and on top?
Both subsurface and on top. Okay. Well, most of the fishing is done subsurface. And I would say that some form of a clouser deep minnow, some, you know, hybrid tie of that, like I said, whether it's a half and half, that would be the pattern, some form of that pattern. I use a lot of just little different variations of it. But basically, it's a minnow imitation, suggested minnow imitation, that I tie in a variety of colors and with different materials. And I think that type of fly is probably, without question, the one I've caught the most fish on and the biggest fish on. Venturing away from that at times now and experimenting with a lot of other different types of flies and styles and that kind of thing. But over a period of years, that's been number one. And I would venture to guess that there probably aren't too many striper fishermen that wouldn't agree with that, at least pretty strongly.
Okay.
Now, that's subsurface. Now, on the surface, there is not a lot of surface fishing done. If you talk to fly fishermen who have caught fish, caught stripers on surface flies or waking flies, I don't know if there would be a single favorite, but there is one that I would say probably would be pretty close to that. And the guys on the West Coast in freshwater have popularized it, the crease fly. Joe Blados or Blados' original pattern, the crease fly. And, of course, they use them on the East Coast in saltwater, too. But that's been a very, very effective pattern for a lot of people over the years. There's another pattern now that can be fished as a topwater or waking fly that's called a Charlie's Airhead. And that was designed by one of the striper fishermen on the West Coast that is fishing that Delta and Lower Sacramento River area. And they do a lot of topwater fishing for stripers. It's kind of a little cult of guys that are doing that. It's phenomenal because they catch some really big fish that way. That's one you can, I'm sure, Google and find. It's called a Charlie's Airhead.
Okay.
The other one that probably I don't hear written about or talked about as much, but it's a phenomenal fly, is Whitlock's Waker Shad. And I remember him saying just in the last few years that it's the best bass fly that he's ever designed and used. And of course, he designed a lot of hair bugs and shad imitations and that kind of thing. It's part of what he calls his sheep shad series. It's the one that's got a deer hair head, and he fishes it kind of down in the, almost like surface film, I guess you'd say, and it just pushes water, and that water being pushed gives a lot of low-frequency vibrations that those stripers can sense, along with other game fish, too, and that's a phenomenal fly for surface or near-surface fishing.
Well, again, we have to take a quick break, but when we return, we'll get more of your questions answered about freshwater stripers. Flats Time Charters is your sponsor for this segment of the show. Captain Bob Jaspers of Flats Time Charters will introduce you to the Mosquito Lagoon, Indian River, and No Motor Zone of the Banana River on the east coast of Central Florida. Only a short drive from Orlando, you will sight fish for big redfish, spotted sea trout, and black drum, as well as a seasonal snook and tarpon. Captain Bob is a lifetime resident of the area and shows his knowledge of the local fish, flora, and fauna. Call Flats Time Charters now and arrange your next memorable adventure. You can reach Captain Bob Jaspers at 321-631-4051. That's 321 631-4051, or go to his website at flatstime.com. That's FLATSTIME.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Bill Butts about freshwater stripers on the fly. If you'd like to ask Bill a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, one of the questions here, and maybe I'll expand upon this, Tom Koch says, lake fish can be very selective. What flies to use and when? Well, you already told us pretty much you're using claws or minnows. So I might expand his question to say, when do you decide to switch up? I mean, to go from color to color. Talk to Kelly Gallup when he's fishing streamers up on the Madison, you know, for trout. You know, he'll switch up every 5 or 10 casts if he hasn't caught a fish, you know, and he's going to a different color trying to find the right color. Do you have a similar system, or how long do you go before you start switching up?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not very consistent at that sometimes. I offer some random thoughts on the lake fishing part of it. I think whether you're fishing a lake or a river for that matter, it's really important to understand, we've talked a little bit about the bait fish, what bait fish it is that perhaps they're keying on. Now that's sometimes difficult to determine, but let's say, for example, it's shad, okay? But shad come in a lot of different sizes depending on, let's say, within a few months after they've spawned, which is right now. I'll give you, this is a case in point. There are jillions of little baby shad, like 1 to 1.5 inch gizzard shad, swimming around in these lakes in our area and a lot of places around the country. And whereas an adult shad would be, say, if it's a threadfin shad, 3 or 3.5 inches, or a big gizzard shad, and you know, a lot of guys that bait fish, they use gizzard shad that are 6 to 10 inches commonly, even though they get bigger than that. So guys get, the fly fishermen are thinking, gosh, I've got to use these horrendous big flies and all that kind of thing. But at certain times of the year, they're keying on these really small, I guess you call them young of the year shad. Again, this is happening right now in a lot of fisheries. So my point is, it's important to find the right size. Sometimes color and hook size, those kinds of things, are kind of out the window. If you've got something that they're looking for, and I'll use the example of, say, a rainbow trout on the Henry's Fork, if they're keying on size 20 pale morning duns and you throw a 14 over them that looks just like the 20 but it's in the wrong size, they're going to look at it and say, no way, man. I mean, that's not what I'm eating right now. Do they get that selective? Yes, they do at times. Know that for a fact. And it's amazing. Sometimes even the really large fish will be selective to small flies. So I think it's really important to kind of understand what size bait they're feeding on. And that's a good reason if you don't know, say you haven't been on a fishery for a while, and you're not familiar with the life cycles of these fish, you want to have something that's an inch or two long and something that's 3 or 4 inches long, which is probably more common, 3 to 5 inches, and then even something bigger. But I think getting information on what's going on in that particular fishery at that point in time that you're going to fish is part of the puzzle you have to solve. And those answers can't come over a phone call right now. They have to come from when you're there, or when you're going. If you're going to Lake Mead next week or Elephant Butte Lake or the Cumberland River, you kind of need to get some questions asked as to what's going on and what they're feeding on.
So the locals may be able to tell you that like you just said, you know, there's an abundance of these small, you know, baby shad right now. So
yes,
maybe you should be working a smaller fly rather than a larger fly. Kind of.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, okay. And back to the information. You know, information is so critical. Through the internet, if you have a discussion board that is fairly active regarding a certain fishery, sometimes you can get good help, sometimes it's really bad, but at least you can try. You can talk to dock owners, guides, who will give you a certain amount of information, you know, and maybe if you're really serious about learning a particular fishery, I'll tell you, if you want to be successful and you're looking at it kind of long term, that's a pretty good investment, as opposed to spending trip after trip after trip and getting frustrated. And, you know, they can educate you a lot on more than just find where the fish are and how to catch them today. They can teach you about the fish themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's talk about equipment. Okay. Harry, or Henry, I'm sorry, Henry in Randolph, New Jersey, asked what size rod, line, and tippet should be used. So maybe you can kind of go through your different rigs that you might have with you.
Yeah, that's I love that topic because, number one, important thing, more so than the size of the line, size of the rod, reel, or whatever, is the line that you pick. But let's talk about rod sizes first. Depending on the fishery, I use anywhere from a 7 weight, and I use, when I say a 7 or 8 or 10, I'm using really stiff rods. They're saltwater rods. The Sage XI2, the Loomis Cross Currents, those kinds of rods that you can throw in wind, cast heavy flies, heavy lines. It's not that they're that much fun to cast, but it's hard to get the job done without them. But we use 7 to 10 weight rods, generally. 8 weight, probably more often than any of them for stripers. Okay, so having said that, the next step is the lines. And if I'm fishing in a boat, and I think there might have been another question about multiple rigs versus just having one rod rig.
Right, yeah, go ahead.
Like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If I'm fishing from a boat where I have the luxury of having multiple rods rigged and ready with flies tied on, I like to carry 3 rods. I'll carry a rod that has, depending on the circumstances, anywhere from a floater or intermediate tip or head on it to a type 3, 3-4 inches per second sink rate, and then something that will sink quite a bit faster than that, anywhere from 6 to 9 inches per second. Those are kind of the 3 levels I like to have rigged. Most of the time I'm using one of the 2 latter ones, either that 3 to 4 inches per second type 3 or something that sinks a lot faster than that. So when you have the luxury, it's great to be able to do that if you have the tackle. And I realize that not everybody does. Not everybody's got 3 or 4 8 weights that they can just rig up. If you don't, and this is a great tool, or if you walk and wade and need to kind of carry one rod and have some flexibility, these multi-tip lines that are made by probably most of the companies now, but the two I'm familiar with and use the most is the Rio VersaTip and the Scientific Angler's Quad Tip. Those lines come with a floating, an intermediate, a type 3, and a type 5 or 6, and then the Rio line, once you get above 8 weight, they also come with a type 8. So they're 15-foot sink tips, that particular one, and they do a wonderful job. Now, having said that, those are 15-foot tips. They also make lines that are interchangeable tip that are 24 or 5-foot heads or tips, as they call them, which allows more of the line to sink down deep. Rio calls it their dredger line. They come with 3 different densities. And they're wonderful lines, and you can get combinations of those. You can order the extra tips of different sink rates, and you can have them all in one nice pouch in your vest or your bag or whatever and be able to interchange those depending on whether you're fishing a shallow run on a river, a shallow flat on a lake, or whether you're fishing a deeper run with some current that might be 8 or 10 feet deep on a river or, you know, a deeper place in a lake. And they're wonderful. They're expensive lines, but you don't have to buy extra backing, extra spools, that kind of thing.
Cheaper than 3 rods and 3 reels, right?
You bet. You bet. So I realize not everybody's, you know, quite at that point. But when I walk and wade, that's what I carry. And they work wonderfully. They're very interchangeable. I think sometimes people tend to not make the change to the other tip, and they're missing out an opportunity to get the fly to the right level of, you know, in the water, the right depth, and that's possible with those tips. So, you know, get them, and if you get one, use them, experiment with them, you'll be glad you did.
You find yourself fishing more from a boat or wading?
I do a lot of both. I saw that question on there too. I really like wading, and I came from a trout fishing background where it's, you know, cold water environment. I like the interaction, the feel of the water and that kind of thing, or even wet wading if it's warmer water fishing. So that's kind of my favorite, but when it comes to lakes and larger rivers, it's just really not very possible, I guess you'd say. So we wade when we can in some of the smaller rivers. Occasionally we will use a canoe and not necessarily fish from the canoe a lot, but use it to get from hole to hole to hole that you can't walk in and get to for access, I guess you'd say. It's nice to be able to carry a cooler with some food and drinks and, you know, some extra tackle and that kind of thing. In a scenario like that, you can carry the extra rods. But then there are many times when we, you know, use a motorboat, if you will, a river john or a shallow running jet boat in the rivers or a bass boat on the lakes. Just whatever is needed, and I have a number of friends that I fish with that have different rigs, and there's just no perfect watercraft for these fish because they're so many different places, but I enjoy all of those. But I think, number one, when I can find them and it's the right opportunity, I really like to wade fish for them.
Do you use a stripping basket?
You know, I know those are getting more and more popular, and rightfully so. I don't use a stripping basket when I wade. The reason is, and it'd probably be helpful at times in a lot of wind, but I don't use full sink lines when I'm wading, or even intermediate lines. I like the lines that have floating running lines, even if they have sink tips, because then the line's not down around my feet when I strip it in. From a boat, when we're fishing deeper lines, full sink lines, intermediate running lines on deep sinking heads, there's a point right there where these stripping buckets, they look like trash cans, but they're a little higher tech, are very, very good, especially if you're fishing fisheries that have a lot of wind, if you're fishing in windy conditions, and the line's not blowing around and getting around a trolling motor control or bag or something else, and that's a frustrating thing. I've not purchased one at this point, but I know a lot of guys that use them, and I should be using them. I think it's a great tool.
Okay, let's take a quick break again, and when we come back, I'd like to talk about locating fish, because I think that's one of the biggest challenges. So as soon as we come back, we'll get into that.
Okay.
At Housatonic River Outfitters, we offer the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with our guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, we offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing guide trips for warm water species. Please tour our website at www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services we offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. We are the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services, and we have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, visit www.dryflies.com. If you're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, we're talking with Bill Betts about freshwater stripers on the fly. If you'd like to ask Bill a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, let's talk then, Bill, about locating fish. Dave George in Lynchburg, Virginia. He says, I just gained access to a well-known striper fishery here in Virginia at Smith Mountain Lake. I'm looking forward to the show for this info. The lake is also known for its partying and playing. I'm sure it is a night fishery due to this. I know how to read the river, but a lake makes me feel like a fish out of water. What and when will it take to hook up? So where do you begin, you know, on a lake to look for stripers? What are you looking for?
Well, I think we've touched on a few things that are key factors, regardless whether it's Virginia or California or New Mexico, and that is you have to learn the uniqueness of each fishery. There are several different patterns, 8 to 10 different patterns that stripers go through during the year in the 12-month cycle that if you learn them, and they're not exactly the same from fishery to fishery, but spawning is one time. Post-spawn is another. Pre-spawn, when they're in the upper ends of lakes getting ready to move up in the rivers. Those are all times of opportunity, but if someone is just learning a fishery, they really are at a distinctive disadvantage. What I would do is offer the advice to really consider talking to a guide. Try to network with other fishermen at tackle shops, online. Again, that can be very good. It can be really bad. In my PowerPoint program I do on these fish, I kind of have a list that I make for resources to kind of get people thinking about what tools to use. I think you need to understand, start learning about the lake itself, the rivers, the tributaries that feed it, and kind of really learn about the fishery itself as you learn about the fish, and that's kind of understanding lake levels, you know, power generation if you've got tailwaters below those. And that fishery that Dave was talking about, the Smith Mountain Lake, I'm pretty sure that's the Roanoke River, which is a very well-known river where the stripers come up out of the ocean below that lake, and they catch lots and lots of stripers, and they're not real big stripers. They seem to come back at a smaller size. But on that lake itself, and let's not talk about so much the lake itself, but at what tools and resources to use, topographical maps, okay, or state-provided special maps. Some states make them, some don't, that show access points for boat launches and that kind of thing. Specific lake maps that show tributaries. In Missouri, we have what we call a conservation atlas, and that's a big book that has every county in the state and where accesses are that are open to the public. Fish and wildlife websites are a great source of information, some better than others. Some, for example, Arkansas does a really nice job with fishing reports every week on all their major fisheries. And that's something that's always put out across the web that I've seen, but again, some are better than others. I mentioned the power generation and water flow and lake water levels. One that a lot of people wouldn't think of is conservation agents, what we call Missouri conservation agents, game wardens. Game wardens are always checking places where they know, especially locals, are fishing or coming back, you know, to a boat ramp. And those people have no reason not to tell you what they know. The state is paying their salaries, and I've found them to be tremendous sources of information, whether it be spawning runs and the timing of that up in a river or on the lakes. Some of them are really good fishermen, some of them aren't, but they're a great source of information in some cases. Fisheries biologists of the states, I've found them to be very cooperative and very helpful with information on specific fisheries. You can call them, you can email them, and sometimes it's hard to get rid of them on the phone. They'll talk to you because they don't have many people talking to them. Again, fishing guides, they sometimes are pretty close to the vest on what they'll tell you, but they have to tell you a little bit. You know, oh, we're catching fish on the surface, or they're really deep, or they're up in the rivers. Sometimes that can give you a little hint, and I think it's a good investment if you're looking at long-term on these commitments to trying to learn how to catch these fish. Certainly bait and tackle shops and fly shops, but I think you'll learn more about stripers at bait and tackle shops because there's more of those guys that are in there buying bait and that kind of thing. And another one I just call local good old boys.
Yeah.
And, you know, we meet guys along the river that are, some of them are a little rough looking, but, you know, we've got their phone numbers in some cases, and we keep in touch with them, and they are very good at helping you understand sometimes when to be where, and you know, are they catching them on the surface, or are they catching them deep again, or are they up in the rivers?
Okay, well, it sounds like a lot of these resources could help identify, you know, generally where and when fisheries might be productive, but
yes.
For instance, Kyle in Hurricane, Utah, he says he lives near Lake Palinau, so always went to fish for stripers there. He's wondering if there's any tricks or shortcuts on how to identify boils on such a big lake. So what I guess the next question then is, we're out on a lake, we know it's got stripers in it, you know, we know from talking to our resources that, you know, that they're not 30 feet deep, that, you know, they're near the surface. How do we go about this big lake on finding them?
Well, and that is a huge piece of the puzzle, Roger, and quite honestly, that's a real hard one to answer. I think that if you know, let's say, for example, in the summer, if you have hopes of finding stripers on the lake, and I'm going to just address the lake because he was talking about the lake.
Yeah.
I think in the heat of the summer right now, and you know, it's 90 degrees here and no telling how hot it is there, but those fish, I'd be very surprised. And again, I don't know much about that lake, but I'd be very surprised if those stripers were on the surface or near the surface very often, if at all, in the heat of the summer. Now, in the fall and the winter and the early spring and through the spring, that's a different thing because they will certainly hunt and they'll get into shallower water. They'll push up bait. Maybe the water's 50 feet deep, but they'll push the bait to the surface and bust into it. But you have to figure out somewhere where to start. You know, do you fish the area around a dam of a lake, the main lake, which is where probably the majority of the year the fish will hang out because there's deeper water near the main lakes, and that deeper water is cooler, and that's what they seek. whether they come into shallower water, shallow flats, windy points. For not only stripers, but white bass and hybrids for that matter, I always look for windy points, and if a lake is flat, I've done very little good on any of those species when the lake was actually flat. It's beautiful to be out there, but windy points and windy flats, where I mean, the wind has blown into that point or that flat for an entire day or perhaps from the same direction 3 or 4 days, you're more apt to find them on the windy side of the lake. And I'll tell you one of the reasons why, especially when you have fisheries that have heavy concentrations of shad. And this is probably the best general idea I can give anyone, but where you have a lot of shad, shad are plankton feeders, and they feed through their gill rakers. And the sun, you know, this plankton blooms in the top layer of the water. And the reason that you have a lot of shad and then those game fish on the windy side of the lake is that plankton is blooming, and as it kind of blows with surface water to one side of the lake continually, it's a microscopic concentration. It's something we can't even see with our eyes, but the shad go that direction with the wind and that concentration. And wherever shad are, the other game fish, not just stripers, are not too far behind. They're usually around somewhere. So I think if you're on a big lake, first of all, you want to have some wind, but I would stay away from the wind, the lee side of the lake. I would go to the windy side of the lake, windy points, windy flats.
Yeah, I know when we were one of a really fun afternoon we had, not fishing for stripers, but fishing for northern pike up in Canada, was where a storm had blown in and the wind was blowing against this cove, and we went into this cove, and literally when your lure hit the water, the bait fish would pop up like popcorn, you know, from the commotion. And we were cast after cast, getting fish after fish, and I think the pike were all in there because, like you say, all the bait fish were pushed in there. And then all the pike came in after them and just created a feeding frenzy then. So it sounds like the same. I never really knew why the bait fish were in there, but now I understand more why the bait fish are in there. So,
well, yeah, this whole thing is such a puzzle. And I think that, you know, in a lot of regards, there are other fish that would be like this. But, you know, fish are, they have to forage. And if you know kind of what their primary forage is in a particular fishery, then you have to sort of learn a little something about the forage itself. And in a lot of cases, it's the shad. And, you know, I mentioned shad and the different shad and the skipjack and rainbow trout and some of those tailwaters. And that is not an exhaustive list. There are many other types of fish that stripers feed on. I do want to make clear something that I think stripers get falsely accused of. Many research projects, research efforts with a variety of states, have proven over and over and over that the introduction of stripers, especially when they get larger, has no negative effect on the existing populations of beloved crappie, bluegill, bass species, smallmouth, largemouth, that kind of thing. It just doesn't, and they have done lots and lots of research. But they are also opportunistic. They will eat suckers. They will eat crawfish. They will eat bluegill. But they also eat a lot of their own young, and that's always something that maybe sounds a little morbid, but they will feed on their own smaller species of the same species.
So to find the stripers, we've got to find the bait fish. Do things like that work in salt, for instance, birds activity, nervous water, other things, are those things that you're looking for?
Those are good indicators, and I think there are probably times when you'll find a good size area of feeding fish and not find birds. So birds are not an absolute indicator, but when you do see birds and they're diving, then they are absolutely a good telltale sign that there's something going on. It may not be stripers. It may be largemouth or Kentucky bass or something else, but that is a great way to zero in. And some lakes have lots of those. They'll have lake gulls and terns and that kind of thing, but that is one that is good, but it's not always available in terms of the birds.
Okay. What about once you've found an area, how do you approach the area? What are your tactics for zeroing in on the fish?
You mean in a lake or a river or either one?
I guess lake, because I think more people can read a river than a lake. I think lakes are more, you know, challenging to most folks.
Well, I think number one, on a lake like that, everybody I know that's fished for stripers on a lake, regardless of the kind of tackle, is when you're trying to approach a group of feeding fish where you know they're there, whether it's a small pod or a large group, you have to be very, very careful. You have to be as quiet as you can. And for a fly fisherman who's limited to, say, casting anywhere from 50 feet to, you know, if you're pretty good, 90 feet, a lot of guys can throw a spinning rod with a jig or some kind of plastic bait quite a bit farther than that. So a fly fisherman's got to get in just a little closer. And that is sometimes really a difficult thing, but you have to try. You may push them down. They don't leave. They just go down, and they keep moving, and they keep feeding. So you have to be very, very careful. Trolling motor, if you see fish at a distance, say, 50 or 100 yards, you crank up a motor and you go to them, you want to cut that engine and coast in and put the trolling motor down. And I've read some really good information in some books that indicate that a trolling motor really doesn't upset fish too much. And this is based on underwater observation. Oddly enough, the same observation said that a canoe paddle was more disturbing to fish going over them or getting close to them than a trolling motor. And I found that kind of hard to believe, but I'm just kind of throwing that out. It's something that intrigued me, but you want to be very careful as you approach with a boat. I do also know of guys and hear more and more of guys using kayaks, of using kick boats and perhaps even small trolling motor powered kick boats or personal watercraft. And that's a great way. If you kind of know the area that they're in, again, you'd have to know the pattern of that particular time that the fish are in an area, say, each evening an hour before dark, and you can kind of position yourself and work in a smaller area. That's a wonderful way to fish for those fish, but obviously you're limited into how far you can range with that kind of equipment. So there's not a perfect watercraft, but if you do have the ability to use a smaller watercraft that's a little quieter and you kind of know where those fish are coming up in their feeding pattern at that particular time, that's a great way to approach it.
Okay. Now, if, let's say we do see, let's call it nervous water, and we see bayfish, would you fish the edges of that? Would you fish at the center of it? How would you approach something like that?
Well, some observations there, and first of all, I think most guys that have fished a lot of schooling fish will tell you that the biggest fish are not the primary aggressors at the surface. I mentioned schoolie stripers, which will be, you know, 1 to 3 year old fish somewhere in the 1 to 5 or 6 pound range. You'll find those kind of fish in more numbers that are really actively busting on the top. But there might be a few of the grandpas laying down there 10 feet or something like that, and they're catching the cripples that are just kind of falling out of the school of bait fish that the others have missed. So they're kind of like the old lazy male lion, you know, after the kill. They let everybody else kill, and then they go in and get what they want. And that's kind of the way stripers, I think there's other game fish like that too. I think walleye and bass and some of those do that. The larger fish don't expose themselves at the surface as frequently. But I try to figure out which way they're headed. Usually they're pushing a school of bait fish in one direction. And you want to kind of watch that because sometimes they'll come right at you. You may be 50 feet from them, and all of a sudden, within just a matter of seconds or a minute, they're all around the boat. And if you hit the side of the boat or something like that, boom, I mean, they're just gone. And they won't go very far at one time, but they won't be right there. And so I try to make sure I know which way they're going, and I'll probably cast right into them more than anything, but or ahead of them a little bit, let that fly sink. And sometimes you get fish that are up high, and if you can let it sink down deep enough, sometimes you're lucky and get a bigger fish down below.
Okay. Now, once you make your cast out there, are there any particular techniques you use as far as retrieve? Stripping?
I think that's where you have to be sure that you don't get into a rut. A lot of guys that come from fishing for trout or smallmouth fishing, kind of the more better known fly fishing, everybody's fished a woolly bugger. You know, the woolly bugger is kind of the Clouser minnow of the trout fishing and smallmouth fishing world. And there just seems to be just a strip, and it's always the same length strip and kind of the same cadence. But I think you have to be real careful to experiment with that. And having said that, I can't tell you that one is better than the other. I know guys that fish a baitfish pattern fast most of the time. I can tell you that bigger fish, you're not going to catch as many larger fish on something moving really fast as you will. You'll catch more smaller fish. The bigger fish won't make as much effort. And a lot of times you can use a little bigger fly, move it a little slower, and those bigger fish will come in there and take it. But you want to be sure that you change up your retrieves. Short, long strip, pause, let it drop if you're using a lead-eyed fly, or let it suspend if you're using one that will just sort of remain neutral buoyancy or neutral in the water, and change it up. And when you find what works, stay with that until it quits working.
Okay. We're getting kind of short on time here. You mentioned fishing deep. Is it just kind of a lost cause in the middle of summer? When I know we have a question from Tom in Roswell, Georgia about, you know, what fish are 30, 40, 50 feet deep. Should we be fishing for something else at that time?
Well, that's a good question, and he was talking about Lake Lanier, which, of course, that is the home waters for Henry Cowan. And I know in that particular lake, and of course, Henry, he guides fly fishermen on that lake, and he does a very good job, but he says that he does not even fish for those fish when they're deep like that. And the reason he doesn't, and it's possible, you know, 30 feet's a long way down, but with these new tungsten lines like the T14 and now T17 that Rio is making, the T14 sinks 9 inches per second. So, you know, to get to 30 feet, it still takes quite a while. The T17, I can't remember what it is, but it's faster than that. Still takes a long time. I personally wouldn't enjoy that unless I was really sure that I was going to catch a really good one. But one of the reasons that a good ethical striper fisherman, I don't care what kind of tackle you're using, wouldn't fish for those fish in the summer is that stripers in these freshwater lakes seek cool water because that's their origin. They like the cooler water. I mentioned earlier 55 to 75 degree water is their ideal temperature range. Well, when the lakes are in the 90 range, 85 to 90 plus degrees, they seek the cooler water. The problem with that is the coolest water is below the thermocline, very deep, anywhere from, say, 20 to way on down. And that water gets oxygen depleted, dissolved oxygen that they have to breathe through their gills. And they won't leave that cold water, but they can't breathe if they don't have a certain amount of oxygen in that water. And a lot of striper fisheries around the country have experienced occasionally a striper kill because of that. They won't leave that comfort zone, but if they can't breathe, then they just suffocate and they die. And a lot of times it's not known because those fish will just sink to the bottom, and not a lot of guys will know that it's actually happened. But that's a good reason not to fish for those fish when it's really deep like that. What we do in the summer in this area, and there aren't very many places, but there are some, is we look for the fish that have access to going up tributaries of a lake or a larger river, up into tributaries that are cooler water or cold water. And I mentioned earlier that some of these are trout fisheries, in most cases put-and-take trout fisheries of several miles of water. And that's really good because it's generally well-oxygenated water, and it's cool. It'll be anywhere from, 50 degrees to perhaps a high of 70 degrees, and that's, right in their very comfortable range. And if there's food there for them, and a lot of times it's trout, certainly shad too, then they're just happy as they can be. And it certainly attracts them. So that's what we look for in the summer, and I just don't fish for them when they're in very, very deep water in the summer.
Okay. And lastly, when you do hook up, any tips on fighting and or landing and handling the fish, considering that, we're going to release them?
Sure. First of all, when we were talking about tackle, we talked about lines. Leaders are really important, and I'll just tell you real quick, I use only about 4 feet on a sinking leader, whether it's a fast sinking or a really, really fast sinking. But I don't go under about a 10-pound test strength, whatever X you want to call that. And we use up to 20-pound if we're fishing really big flies and the water's off color or in different circumstances, but usually between 10 and 15-pound is what we use for tippets. Now, having said that, if you're using a 7, 8, or 9 weight rod, you can put a lot of pressure on a striper with that kind of tackle and that kind of tippet. You want a good strong hook. I generally use some type of saltwater hook. And I fight them very, very hard and very, very aggressively because sometimes the striper's got a very hard, bony mouth, and sometimes you don't get that hook penetration, even if you sharpen them and mash the barbs and all that. So I put the pressure on them. I hit them hard with the strike, a lot of pressure on them, and I keep the pressure on them until I've got them either beached or I use a boga grip, the little grabber thing that locks onto the jaw. Either one of those is really good, but I really, really like to keep a lot of pressure on them. The other thing that's important with the rod is to keep a low rod angle so that the mid and butt sections of your rod are fighting the fish and keeping the pressure on them, and that way you can beat them quicker. And my other thought on that, based on his question, was to, when you can, keep the fish in the water. Don't even take them out of the water, almost like catching a big trout. If you can boga one or beach one in real shallow water, just keep them down in the water, lift them up to take a picture or two, and then put them right back in the water and let them start to fight very, very hard, and they will expend themselves. And if you happen to catch one in really warm water, above 80 or 85 degrees, it might take them a while to revive, and some of them will actually die. So the faster you can beat them and the more gently you can handle them and get them back going, put them right back in the resource to enjoy them again, that's best.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but thanks, Bill, for working with us tonight. And if you'll just hold on, Bill, and stick with us till the rest of the show here, I'd appreciate it. We're going to do some giveaways.
Sure.
One of the things we're going to give away is a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. We're going to do that through our drawing. And then we're going to give away a $20 gift certificate to Front Range Anglers based upon a question we ask about something we talked about during the show.
Okay.
So hang tight for just a minute. We'll do that. Family Ties, that's T-Y-E-S. Family Ties is an organization which uses a shared interest in fly fishing and fly tying to enhance youth development and family relationships. They utilize resources in schools, communities, and businesses, and they invite your participation. Go to their website at www.familytyes.com, familytyes.com, where every fish is a trophy and every kid is a hero. Okay, just a quick reminder to everyone before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? And just click on that, leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to pick our winners, and the first drawing we're going to do is for the 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers. Now, if you haven't registered yet, it's too late now, but, you know, be sure you're there next time on our show and register in advance because, you know, we're always giving away some of these great gifts. So let's see. These are randomly picked from our database of registrations, and see what we get here for the Federation membership. And we've got Jim Coates in New Hampshire. Jim Coates in New Hampshire. So congratulations, Jim. If you're already a member, we'll get that extended for you. And if not, we'll get you a 3-year membership. And our second winner for Fly Fusion magazine, 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. And that's a great magazine out of Calgary, Canada. FlyFusionMag.com is their website, FlyFusionMag.com. And my computer's being a bit slow here. And here we go. Jack Lehman in Texas. Jack Lehman in Texas. So, gentlemen, we will contact you and tell you how to go about getting your gifts tonight. And we'll email you with that information. So, now, let's go right here. Hold on. Got to get to a different screen. Going to ask a question here, and this is a question based upon us talking tonight, and you need to answer this question on our homepage through that text box that's there on our homepage. Now, you need to put in the answer, and you need to put in your name and your location to qualify for this. Now, I am trying to clear my queue here because last week I got a little static because somebody answered the question before I asked it, and I gave them the prize for anticipation, but there's not going to be any anticipation this time. So I'm going to make sure my queue is clear here before I ask the question. Okay, So the question is, there were a couple types of bait fish, shad being one of them, that are quite common, but Bill mentioned a particular kind of bait fish that gets a lot of trophy striped bass, and it was not a shad. What was it? What was the name of that bait fish? It's a little tougher. Well, usually a lot of them can guess, Bill, in advance what I'm going to ask, so I'm trying to be a little bit more cagey about this whole thing, and I'm waiting here for somebody to respond. Okay, I've got one answer, and nope, that's wrong. I'll tell you that right now. Okay, I've got one answer here that has half the name right, Bill, and I've got another answer that has the other half of the name right, but neither of them have put it together yet. So
this must be a hard one. I don't know if I could get it.
You don't know if you could get it. Okay, so what I'm going to do here is the first person that answered it was Andy Cordova in Albuquerque, and he guessed herring. Okay, so being that nobody answered the full question here, I think we'll give it to Andy. Is that, I know it's skipjack herring, but he got the right family anyways.
Yeah, I think that's fair. What were the other answers?
Well, skipjack, and then another herring, and then we had trout, we had some other things there that didn't apply at all. But so we'll give it to Andy Cordova, and I know he's already owed another prize, I think, so he's got another one. He won on another show, so we're going to have to get him taken care of. But congratulations, Andy. That was a little tougher, huh, guys? A little tougher. You know, they're not going to be as easy in the future, so you're going to have to pay more attention. So anyway, well, hey, Bill, thanks so much for being on the show tonight. I really appreciate it and taking your time out. I know we took you away from some night fishing down there, but but we surely appreciate your time.
Well, I enjoyed it very much. I know we could have talked for hours because there were a lot of important subjects to cover that we only touched lightly on, but at least we got it started, and they can email me if they'd like.
Yeah, that'd be great. And why don't you give them your email address again one more time?
Okay, it's bill.butts, B-U-T-T-S as in Sam, at sbcglobal.net. And SBC is like Sam Bravo Charlie, SBC.
Great, terrific. Well, and we're going to be having Bill back probably. I think we've tentatively scheduled a show in December and talking about white bass and differences there. So I look forward to that show. Our next broadcast will be on August 19th at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, we're going to interview Harry Murray, and our topic for the show will be fly fishing streams for smallmouth bass. Harry Murray has been fly fishing, guiding, and teaching others about smallmouth bass most of his life, and you'll find his practical approach to finding and hooking up with these exciting fish an enlightening experience. So listen in and learn his secrets. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Flats Time Charters, Royal Gorge Anglers, and the Housatonic River Outfitters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company might benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115, extension 2. That's 888-961-1115, extension 2, and we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com, and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.